Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Think about it. Deep conversations with Uli Bear on big ideas and great books.
Welcome, Steph, to the Think About It podcast today. I'm so happy to have you here. So we're here with Stefanos Girilanos, who is an author, a historian, and he's written this book, The Invention of Prehistory, Empire, Violence, and Our Obsession with Human Origins. So first of all, congratulations on this new book, and I'm really excited to have a conversation and learn from you.
Thank you.
We both teach at NYU. We are in New York right now. And I want to start us out maybe by some of the things that I'm aware of in our culture, which is a paleo diet, reptile lizard brain, fight or flight, Lucy, or like our sort of common grandmother, like sapiens versus Neanderthals, innate aggression versus cultural aggression, tools make the man, all these ideas that have dinosaurs, like where we come from, that it informed who we are. And I want to start out by asking, why did you write a book on prehistory, this moment in time that's kind of lost to us, but everybody for the last 250 years seems to have been so invested in recreating and bringing to life in a completely exciting way?
Right. So first off, thank you for having me, Uli. This is
really fun. Yeah.
So like you, like many others, I just simply would get excited about where things were, things that would show up either on my feed or in the news or in, you know, some sort of Scientific American article that would come up as it went. And the way that I kept thinking about it is that there's always a quiet definition of what it means to be human. It's there. You don't really have it explicit, but you have some hints. And so sapiens versus Neanderthal, you know, humans as tool makers in the computer age. What else did you cite before? The lizard brain, which was particularly popular in 2016 with Trump's election.
We all come out of Africa.
Exactly.
In a good, thrilling way, we share something, or in a way we've escaped some other state of being.
Exactly. And so there was a way in which I kept thinking, I can never tell in all these publications how much of this is coming out of serious science,
right,
and how much of this is coming out because it's a concept that's used. And somehow with, you know, with little moments that I was studying for totally different reasons, I just kept thinking the politics of this is very strange.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the people involved in these stories have, you know, it's like they have a kind of return of the repressed attitude, like they had been treated as though they were charlatans early on in their scientific life, and then suddenly they turn out to be right, and they go completely all in, as aggressive as they possibly could. And I found this totally fascinating. And so it was a little bit like story by story.
Right.
I kept finding that it's not that the science is bad, it's that so much work is defined by the concepts that people use. And that gets super exciting on the one hand, because it is about the common language that we all use, and sometimes that scientists use, but that trickles back and forth.
Right.
And then a lot of the time, it's just really grim, politically really grim stuff. And I just kept thinking, you know, where is it that the colonial story ends and the scientific story begins? And very often it's quite nicely separated, and very often they're just basically one and the same. But so that was the backstory.
The idea of prehistory, like where is that in both in actual history, and I never get these things right. Is it 3 million years or 300,000? I'm not accurate about any of the things. Like, where's prehistory?
So
like,
I totally love that, because that's kind of the problem. In some versions of prehistory, or well into the 19th century, it was entirely unclear to everybody involved how far in the past it was. For the most part, it was far enough in the past for Europeans to look like colonized peoples elsewhere.
Okay.
So the basic idea was you could, if you could draw the comparison and say our ancestors look like X.
Like people that Europeans met in other places.
Exactly.
So in some ways, the people we were once are like the people today we're encountering in other parts of the world.
That's exactly
the European fantasy.
Exactly. Okay. So it's as though from the ancient Germans that Tacitus had written about in Caesar and so on, they had moved in the later 19th century to saying, well, the Neanderthal is far in the past, probably like the people of the Andaman Islands or like Aboriginal Australians. And so that vagueness then follows a history of the different sciences. One version is you get the linguists for whom language is all that matters, and they don't have a kind of temporal scenario that they know how long it's taken.
Because we have no evidence whether language was used.
Okay. Exactly, or where it comes from. Right. So then they start finding motherlands, basically, for Indo-European languages to come from, and contrasting them with languages, either Semitic languages or other languages that they see in Europe, Basque and Northwest Caucasian languages. The evolutionists couldn't care less about this. And so for them, it's a kind of calculation of how long it would go. And other people are archaeologists, and they say, well, it's pretty clear that there's a real distinction between stone and bronze.
Okay.
And then we can subdivide as to how it goes. And so in large part, the easy solution that most people work with is prehistory is pre-agricultural, so pre-Mesopotamia. But the Mesopotamian argument is from the 1920s, 1930s.
Okay. It didn't pre-agriculture.
Pre-agriculture, pre-writing.
Pre-writing, yes.
And pre-bronze.
And
so
pre-bronze.
Basically the Neolithic period, but those are not entirely mappable. And for a lot of the time, they weren't mappable at all.
And let me ask you a question. Is this, and I don't know if I'm right at all.
That's fine.
This starts developing, let's say, roughly around like 1800, a little before that. Is that because we're starting to think maybe we're not descendants of Adam and Eve, and there's a kind of secular need for a story that explains where we come from? And before that, the story is given to us by religion. We come from our forefathers, and the church tells us who they were.
That's basically
so this is a secular idea that we need to find what is this prehistory if it's not paradise from which we've been expelled.
That's exactly right. So there are ways in which religion and religious people try to negotiate this. I find the negotiation really interesting.
Really interesting, yeah.
But for the most part, this is basically a secular idea.
But let's say the religious people, and in your book, you kind of leave them behind in a way.
Yes, and maybe unfairly, but for the most part, they're left behind. Yeah.
But it's sort of the discussion you're chronicling. It's 250 years of people debating, and it's funny the way that they're arguing about who we were once with a huge amount of fervor and passion.
Yes.
Like I had Melissa Schwartzberg on here on Rousseau.
Yes.
Which I really like, and I always teach that kind of this idea, which as far as I know, he never used the term noble savage himself.
Yes.
Rousseau, but this idea that we were once more innocent and then property becomes the problem. And there are these moments when we used to live in a certain way and then something is introduced or we invent something and then we get corrupted or we become who we are today.
Right. And so some of these versions, you know, so first Rousseau, the book starts with Rousseau in large part because I think that the way he flips the state of nature argument produces a set of possibilities for the people that come after.
So tell me how he switches that state of nature argument.
As opposed to suggesting that there's a kind of straight up progress since the state of nature. State of nature is, I don't use so much the word innocence as a kind of, there's a kind of purity to it. And so people after him have to negotiate, do we go with a kind of semi-Rousseauian story so about the beginning.
So the first one is we go from this
purity
and then we move up in some way or move on or how does...
Right. So one version is the kind of Hobbesian savagery to, you know, modern civilization.
Okay.
The Rousseauian argument is basically that the beginnings are not a version of a savage story.
Yeah.
There is violence, there is strength, but there is a kind of purity to those which is unlike society as we get to learn it. But then you have all these people from Herde to Isaac Eiseland and others who have to negotiate, now what exactly are we supposed to do? And come up with various scenarios in which you may have a version of a noble savage, you may not really care for a version of a noble savage, but you have to negotiate the purity, innocence, sort of rise, decline, various options, depending on the politics that you have. And that becomes the basis, I think, thanks to which when the geological revolution hits in the early 1800s, that negotiation of what the beginning was like becomes the basis for really asking again exactly when did human beings show up? Yeah. And, yeah. You know, in the absence of a kind of divine guarantee, what exactly were they? And that is a real switch from a religiously based standpoint to a much more secular one.
And when we want to know where we come from in this more scientific way, not just, you know, God placed us here or something like that, or Adam is the original forefather, why do you think there is this kind of urge? Because in your title, you have the obsession with origins. And yeah. I was very fortunate, I studied with Jacques Derrida,
yeah.
who was really interested and who actually said, we do need origin stories.
Yes.
He just said they're just quite complicated and he would sort of deconstruct them and said, but like in my memory, Derrida was not opposed to them. He said they're necessary because they give us a sense of where we come from, because it may give us some roadmap of where who we are today and where we will be.
Yes.
So do you think this tracing, this origin, is this book, do you think there's a problem with finding an origin and putting that story in there? And there's a lot of really popular books, as we know right now, mm-hmm. that sort of say this is the beginning point.
I mean, I think the problem is not so much that it's not as though I could write a book that would get rid of origins. That's not the form. And I'm very much with the Derrida argument from The Origin of Geometry, that there is something about the moment that's presumed pure, something about this moment that's presumed to be a kind of ignition scenario, which is that it isn't all as simple as that. And it gets really interesting when we start examining what mm-hmm. would that space be. So the way that I put it simply is, I love these origin scenarios and these origin stories, but very often there is a political consequence to this argument. If you follow a sort of Yuval Harari argument,
right,
then you're left with an idea of human beings as basically capable in large numbers of making what they think into reality.
So and Harari, this is the book Sapiens,
that's big bestseller, Sapiens, which exactly.
a lot of people read. And so he has this idea that we form ideas, we share these ideas, and then we all kind of muddle together to enact this idea.
Yes.
It's a kind of amazing thing that creativity is what makes us human.
Exactly. Like and that's like a 90s and 2000s scenario.
Yeah. yeah.
And it comes from an argument about the cognitive revolution. He repackages it. He gives it a much more Silicon Valley scenario. But most of our lives are not really that creative. They're, you know, like the boring right. things from a supermarket to something else.
Right.
Life is not an app. And so if there is a way in which his book fits perfectly with a moment in which there is a real receptivity for something like, how is it that the world will look different, will look better, how can my phone use, and so on.
Yeah.
If you have someone like Graeber and Wengrow, they...
So that book is called The Dawn of Everything.
The Dawn of Everything.
What do they posit as, where do we come from? What's in the beginning? What happens in the beginning?
So in their version, what matters really is the Neolithic Revolution. It's a moment of great... So we would talk about 4,000 years ago. It's a moment of a kind of upheaval. It's a moment when people move into much more, well, not, I meant 4,000 years BCE, not ago. It's a moment when people move into settlements, but they don't really move into very stable settlements.
Okay.
For them, this is a moment of a kind of cultural anarchy.
Okay.
It suggests that human beings, unless forced by the state, you know, they like to put down here, then they move, they decide to go somewhere else, they see how they go, and things are sort of up in the air. And that's a vision of humanity, which has also to do with the desire not to be, you know, politically over-defined in the present moment, which is one of Graeber's political priorities.
And they find, so in this book, The Dawn of Everything, they find some way to be self-aware and present, to say, mm-hmm. since things were more disorganized and people had different options, and one option becomes maybe dominant, but it's not necessarily the right one.
That's right.
So it's a contingency.
That's right.
And Harari satisfies what need that we want to believe about ourselves.
So I'm much more sympathetic to their version.
Yeah.
Harari's version, I think, is the one that you read before bed to tell you that tomorrow morning you're going to be creative, you're going to make the future. If you are a kind of, you know, Silicon Valley person, you're really building new gods. I mean, that's the terminology right. that he uses. And I find that
But
weird.
Is that only, is yeah. it really only tech bros? Isn't it also a little bit like, I kind of want to believe this too.
Yeah, that's what I
kind of want to believe that actually I have this, I have some potential in me that is innate. And this is where it goes back to all the stories you tell in this book, that I want to find something in me. And if I look at these creatures from millions of years ago, somehow I think there's something more real to me than all this, what you call in one of your chapters, the veneer of civilization.
Yes.
I hope it's not pure aggression, but I hope there's something in me that's human, but not, hasn't been shaped by my social context. So I think we look back at these ancient
So that's the other version.
Right?
I think you gave the extended version of what I was hoping to get to in a way, which is that in the absence of another definition for what human is, origins fill the gap. And so it's not origins as an origin science most of the time.
Right.
It's the reception of that. And origin science also feeds this, tries to publicize itself. But so it's the way in which instead of having a kind of hard definition, this is human, that is not, because we can't really do that today.
Yeah.
We easily move into that kind of scenario. If we tell the story this way, that's the origin myth and where we're going. And I totally want to believe that I'm at once anarchic, super creative, and this and that. But there is a way in which you could say...
Do you want to be anarchic, super creative?
Super creative, what else do we have?
What would you like to believe, like, in some regard?
Goodness.
And this is not you as a scientist, but sort of say... Because your book is really about this investment we have. And in some ways, what I loved about the book, that you think there's a bunch of natural scientists, paleontologists, historians, lay people, archaeologists, all these people... dreaming up things. There are some stars in here like Darwin, Freud, big names, but that everybody's sort of household names, but they satisfy something. So you want to be anarchic, self-creative, because there is a there's something positive. That's what I want to get to first before like, oh my God, we have all this, these stories are producing bad politics. They're also producing something else.
Yes. I think that there's a way in which several of the stories tell us that the world could indeed be different, that we could contribute to something that's both scientifically rigorous and politically transformative.
Okay, okay.
I think that we all love a version of this scenario, which is why these are books that succeed at times. It's not always the case.
Yeah.
But the telling the story in a particular way rather than another, and I want to give one quick example, allows you to escape certain politically problematic things. Now, these politically problematic things change at different moments, but it is something that helps. So, in the post-war period, and this is one of my favorite chapters in terms of the, what did I come out liking? In the post-war moment, a really key switch has to do with technology, where they begin to think, in order to avoid a kind of biological evolutionism, which leads to racism, leads to eugenics, leads to all sorts of political disasters at that point, thinking of Africans as killer apes and so on. They move to technology and they say, like, basically it's these stone tools that make all the difference. Yeah. And why do they make the difference? Because we didn't start with big-brained humans. We, you know, whoever this we was, were apes who at first had used their hands for locomotion and then began to hit stones against each other. And the stones become like organs of the body and begin to transform it. So that's why we get a sort of straight posture. That's why the our heads have kind of shrunk compared to ape or Australopithecus heads. And the idea is that basically the tools themselves created by humans basically created next generations of humans. That scenario...
Wait, stay with this for a moment. So the tools we don't know, accidentally, intentionally, it doesn't matter, we created, they then start transforming us.
Exactly.
In our use of tools...
we become more human. Because the idea is that, you know, if you're bent like this, you really can't really hit the stone. You can't lift both your hands to hit the stones. Whereas if you're somewhat more balanced, then you can hit the stones further. So you gradually have these sorts of shifts by people pushing back and, and so on. That idea that our technical being is essential to our, you know, not thinking, to our bodies and so on. I mean, it's essential to someone like Stiegler, but it's, I think, also a story that we've grown to live with.
And why do you like this? Why do you like this story? Because it places
because
it's
not
innate
a kind of,
us as a biological or a thinking animal or what?
Right. So I think I started getting into the story to say they pick this specifically to avoid the biology. Mm-hmm. And I like the story in a way for this, that they've come up with something that's not exactly a humanism.
Yeah.
The motor of history is technology.
Right.
It's not simply a big brained ape or a bigger brained ape or a figure of dominance or a figure of revolution or something like that. There is something that's entirely uncontrollable by us.
And but in your book, you don't really show your cards so much.
Yeah,
like in some ways, you play it kind of close to the vest because I didn't really get a sense like, oh, this is the story that Stefanos really likes. You said, this is a story, this is a story, this is a story. And there was a little part of me where I thought, I was trying to make sense of the book, and I thought it's so many different stories. They all serve contemporary purposes. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like the American philosopher Richard Rorty, who said a very convincing and well-told story is going to be the foundation of our morality, because he didn't believe there was innate morality. So a well-told story shared by people, et cetera, has certain characteristics. That's an effective story that makes us into who we are. And you sort of chronicle these stories. So the one is with the tools.
Yes.
And tell me like two or three other ones, how we become who we are.
I mean, which ones do I love? well, I don't know how to put it. There's a way in which the people that I liked the most that I was reading were the people who lived in doubt. So Juliet Mitchell, Georges Bataille, you know, to a degree Freud as well.
Yeah.
Though I'm more on the skeptic Freud than the Freud of building the primal father.
And they share a skepticism in what sense?
In that they're not willing to be told a story that's entirely satisfying, that you can kind of overthrow one prehistory, come up with your own one, and then
like, let's say that it's not the tools, but it's language, or it's the bigger. And so what other options
so think,
are? What
so
other
think,
models
for example,
are there?
When Mitchell writes Psychoanalysis and Feminism, a big
so this is 1970s, a kind of feminist critique of a male-dominated field.
And right, like, but she's basically saying, like, look, Freud is not here to be. We can't overthrow Freud as if we simply got rid of the patriarchy with him. He's an excellent tool for thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we get more analytical tools for thinking about where we came from rather than saying we came out of this relationship between male and female apes.
And is her
More of a surprise in that case. At that moment, it's a surprise.
Is her criticism also because the story that had been told was hunter-gatherer, man goes out, hunts big game, woman stays at home, takes care of the kids. This kind of nuclear story, which has been, the Museum of Natural History in New York City, which we all, I mean, I love.
I love
my
it
kids
too.
Love.
I love it too. I love
but
all this stuff. That's
it told a story. And I think when you go into that, those dioramas, they tell a story. And Juliet Mitchell said, they somehow tell a story that may have, and is she trying to say, this may not have been what it was? Or
that's right. So both she and, so there's a whole generation in the 70s of feminists who say the man, the hunter scenario is really BS. We have, it's not simply man the hunter, woman the gatherer.
Yeah.
But then comes the second generation, which is closer to Mitchell and is the is also the archaeoanthropologist Margaret Conkey and others who say, like, well, actually, we really don't know anything about anything that they were doing in this space.
And do we know,
to understand
do we know
the tools.
Anything?
Well, it appears that we know a lot more at this point in that we have skeletons. For example, where it's clear that female early humans would use arches, would use, what do you call
bow and arrow,
it? Bow and arrow, thank you, archery, I was thinking before. So, so it's clear that there is a complexity, but that complexity is not solved.
Yeah.
It doesn't get reduced to something easy. And it doesn't mean that geographically it's not very different here than it is over there.
Okay.
So, or even among different ethnic groups.
But your book is not really concerned with what is really the truth of this? And
right.
do we, like,
Entirely
is
right.
there going to be the scientific discovery coming along and we'll have on our phone an alert and they finally found whatnot? This was the 19th
yes.
century obsession. We're going to find the missing link. We're going to find this. We're going to find that. Your book is not about that. Your book is more like, there's evidence, and people will create a story out of that, or a
yes.
theory, right?
Yes.
And you're saying this story serves...
It. And then the story will change. But what's interesting to me is that people will go to do the next bit of their scientific research with that story in mind.
Okay.
And some of that story will get perpetuated.
Yeah.
And sometimes when they overthrow one story, they will move straight into another story they had overthrown only very recently because the options are very limited. So it's true. I didn't write the book to get to what the truth would be because then that would be kind of recreating what everybody else is doing. I was more interested in, and I am much more interested in, how is it that people think? How is it that if we take something that's both vast and relatively specific, in what way do people, do scientists, as well as lay people like me, turn around to say, when I encounter this evidence, these are the words I use, these are the images I have in mind, these are the metaphors that come into the interplay. Like these ideas that travel that we don't know that they travel, or we don't notice that they travel.
And we don't notice because these concepts or images or ideas, are they sort of part of our vocabulary and we're not aware that someone created them because they seem intuitive to us by this point? Or
I think that's right.
They just become so...
But there's a kind of intuitive scenario. So I have one example. I remember an article in the New York Times maybe 5-6 years ago in which they had found a new hominin on an island in Indonesia. And so the scientist that they're speaking with is describing, it's a fascinating setup. And at the end, someone says, well, how did they get to this island and this island alone? And someone in the group responds, well, we think that they were washed off, you know, some other island and ended up here, maybe during a tsunami. And
I think it's a novel by Daniel Defoe, Robinson Crusoe.
Well,
I think I've read it.
My reaction was like, wait, this is great. It's kind of amazing that they could. Statistically, it's impossible. There's no possible way that somebody could, that you could have two, you know, not to say more of a particular species that end up there. And then you have to say, well, part of the setup is that clearly we cannot think about ancients as seafarers.
Yeah.
It's clearly that we don't have better evidence and we land on that possible solution. We have the kind of automatic question. And then, but I remember reading it and having spent already a couple of years working on this and being like, that is amazing. Wait, no, that can't be. And so, but I had this reaction all the time. You'll learn things like, you know, Neanderthal genes are responsible for nicotine addiction, obesity, and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds, it's like you nod ahead, and at some point you have to say, well, also responsible is the fact that I smoke, or that I eat, or that this is the kind of culture I'm in. So the genetic part, interesting. We're probably not going to end up with a fully genetic explanation of things. But it is a little bit tricky when we get these sorts of explanations that are published and republished and republished. What was it the other day? Neanderthals are responsible for us, for some of us being morning people. That doesn't mean anything in a way, you know? Maybe genetically,
and
but
Phil,
we don't wake up early out of our genetic setup.
Fill me in on the Neanderthal sapiens tale, which drives a little bit of the story of Harari. But in your book, where does the Neanderthal fit in and what does it do? Because it's a word we use today kind of almost as a slur. It's like, you're such a Neanderthal. That's supposed to be crude, uncivilized, not sophisticated, brutish.
Yes.
Right?
Over-masculine.
Over-masculine. Sorry, so where does the Neanderthal, if you just give me that, when is he discovered and what does he do in our self-understanding?
So I say in the book that the Neanderthal is discovered in a debate in around 1860.
Okay.
After a particular cranial dome has been discovered in the Neander Valley near Düsseldorf in Germany.
Yeah.
There have been several other skulls at that point that have been discovered. In other places, in Gibraltar.
So he's named after a place,
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's the one that sparks the discussion.
Yeah.
And from the beginning, the question is this human or is this just outside of the human?
Okay.
Is it a quote-unquote extinct race or is it a different species of some sort?
Okay.
And you get all sorts of debates.
And what would it make a difference if it were not a human species like this other species? Why would that be important at that time in the
I think that at the time, there was a real question as to whether this was an originator of modern humans.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in Germany, one debate hinges on whether this is simply a pathological case or a set of pathological cases, or were the ancestors of the ancient Germani, you know, something like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Are these like the most indigenous people Europe ever had?
Okay.
And so you end up having the question of, oh, and there's an additional question which has to do with monogenistic versus polygenistic hypotheses. So could this resemble somebody from the Andaman Islands or somebody from somewhere in Africa?
Okay.
Is the debate that they had was, does this indicate separate conceptions? Are the racial differences so significant? Are we so superior to this as we are to others and so on? And then this becomes a debate that basically takes, it develops two images. One image is a kind of colonial brutish image where the Neanderthal looks ever more like a gorilla and is seen as being just beyond the limits of the human.
Okay.
So for example, the Neanderthal sculptures made in Belgium at the time that Belgium was brutalizing the Congo look particularly ape-like.
Okay.
The Neanderthals look particularly ape-like. In the other tradition, you have the idea that Neanderthals are kind of our mirrors. We could have been them.
Okay.
And there are moments when people begin discussing this around 1910, but very, very cautiously, and they're really not very sure of it. That's not the public perception. The public perception is the public perception you just described. And from the 1950s, you have first a story of Neanderthals as oppressed by sapiens, as being a kind of, I remember one book, The Neanderthals Rediscovered, that says basically by the 1970s, they become like the super Indian, like a kind of super stereotype. They're super trackers. They know how to live in the harshest conditions possible to humans and so on. So you get these two stories. One scenario is the backwards, the backwards brutish humans that we would have been. And the other scenario is these are our siblings.
Okay.
And that basically has been resolved effectively through the genetic study, at least in the sense so that the scientists, including Svante Paabo, who won the Nobel Prize for decoding with his lab the Neanderthal genome, that scenario is the one that says, like, look, we don't, the old version was of the brutish Neanderthal. The current version is much closer to, these were very similar to us. They were capable perhaps of art. There's a debate around whether they were.
Right.
They made the earliest art. And so it seems as though as one population of, you know, relatively small but unclear size, Neanderthals are no longer to be seen in that description. One messy consequence of this is that Neanderthals are also now depicted as white and blonde and blue-eyed. And all of the major reconstructions of the last 20 years.
It's a bit of an overcorrection.
You see, so it's corrected to the point where you just have to say, I hope that somebody begins to notice that this is a politically really tricky scenario, because then you look online, which I unfortunately had to do to make sure that this was the case.
Right.
And people will say, yeah, how did diversity work for the Neanderthals? All these Africans came in and killed them. And so there's or mated with them and swamped them. There are scientific papers that refer to genetic swamping.
Yeah.
So you have to end up at this point of just saying, we do need a measure of doubt to go back to the earlier discussion.
Yeah.
And we do need a scenario where we can't be saying we did this, we were that, we.
Okay.
There has to be a kind of early modern humans, so to speak, versus other species, but there can't be an identification because the moment there's that identification, what would have been a scientific story becomes a popular and a personal myth that people then use in a kind of Harari or other fashion.
Although in your book, you don't really... I didn't really feel that you made this distinction as you just did so clearly. Yeah. It would be a popular story versus a scientific story because especially, it seems to me, in the 19th century, but up to today, scientific stories are also popular and cultural stories.
Yes.
And as you said, they're not totally free from this and they just use scientific objectivity and everybody else is now using a kind of like weak version of this and comes up with their own political stories. Yes. You're saying the problem is that even these scientific paradigms are informed by all sorts of belief systems,
yes.
Right?
I mean, first off, remember the key problem. Every scientist has to get, at some point in their life, a grant.
Yeah.
In the grant, they're not going to say...
No, they used to be sons of rich families.
Well, yes.
There was that.
Maybe that was a different story.
I think that was the way they did it in the 19th century.
But now the scenario says, you know, we need to study these, like, finger bones, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to write... I've written grants, too. You're not going to write at the end, what will they show me? What the, you know... second knuckle was like, you're going to say it tells us something really essential
right.
about the advent of tools and the advent of humanity. Now, when you enter that scenario, you've already brought in all this outside world. I don't think that there's a strict distinction. Also because we have quite different sciences in operation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So geneticists are not doing the same thing as archaeologists are doing. Mm-hmm. Archaeologists are not doing the same thing as, you know, geologists are going to end up working in, mm-hmm. or as other people who do neuroscientific work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these people are not doing the same as you would get in a museum. And in a way, it's a complex of sciences out of which there isn't exactly a very straightforward story that comes out.
Yeah.
It's not a simple solution. Now, that's not a bad thing. That is a good thing. We don't need to be acting as though we need a version of, like, here's how we solved all the problems in one fell swoop. And in the process of this, a kind of popular language is going to creep in, even if you're trying to be really rigorous.
Right.
Again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you need to be translatable to people. So that becomes a kind of curiosity. What I'm trying to say with all this is that I haven't written this to say scientists are horrible or that they're wrong or this or that, nor that scientists are good and people are horrible, but just to say that there is a dynamic that is often really troubling. And just as we need to be, you know, concerned about other troubling matters in life, this is a dynamic that's also to be, we also should be concerned with. And that dynamic is one in which old theories survive. Even weird old theories survive.
Mm-hmm.
Theories that have relatively little scientific purchase survive and thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, scientific theories have to exist and learn to exist with this kind of language that is not simply theirs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is what it means for us as humans to be wondering who we are as humans. But unfortunately, it also means that we can't help it at times, but create these long stories in complete ignorance of the politics that comes with it. Part of what I wanted to do with the book was to say, I don't think that anybody's paying attention to how profoundly problematic even our heroes in these stories are.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is not to say, you know, Darwin was a eugenicist, therefore begone Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck with that.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is to say...
And you're saying good luck because it seeped into their culture. And even if we say, we'll, in this shorthand, which is not really productive, we cancel Darwin. Darwin has already sort of actually shaped subsequent thinking in a way that we can't even really trace.
Exactly. Yeah. So even, and at the end of the day, whatever we do with Darwin, eugenicism is all over contemporary culture. We thought it had been gone and it's come back.
And how do you mean, in what sense?
I mean, first off, in far right, in various far right political schemes, that would be one scenario. I think the other scenario where we accept genetic explanations for things is a real problem. So this, like, Neanderthals tell us that our weight issues are because of that. No, they're because of a social system.
And do you think there's a problem to substitute this idea, we are this way, because here's the proof, this old story, these people used to do this. And you're saying it sort of takes away the need to analyze where we are right now, what our conditions are. So instead of saying, like, look, I'm kind of, I get really easily angry because, and that's probably because my ancestors 3 million years ago got angry a lot, or I can't resist sugar because, like, I learned this from, you know, Michael Pollan or something like that. Like, because when I find a bush of berries, I have to eat all of it.
Because I used
to live in the savannah. So you're thinking this absolves of some current responsibility.
Exactly. Okay. I think that's the problem. I think the problem is that human beings now have virtually no, are virtually incomparable to human beings 100 years ago.
So that's a big takeaway.
Much more from a very long time ago.
So that's a big takeaway of the book, that you're saying we need to study these origin stories. I also do believe we need some stories of where we come from. It's important for us because to be totally adrift makes people not very comfortable.
Yes. Then
you're saying we are so different from the people, these our so-called ancestors. We are so different, much more different than we can imagine, that to sort of create this story, this developmental story, whether it's decline or ascent, it doesn't matter. We go up or we go down, we come from there. That it has not very little to do with us.
Exactly right.
But it does fulfill this. And I wanted to go back to one thing about the political uses of this.
Yeah.
I actually felt in some cases they were also good things because they revised the story and sort of it's not only, but it is a really important part, kind of, let's say, the feminist critique of a kind of male-centered paleontology or something that was productive. So in some ways you can say the origin stories are not just, they all lead to horrible conspiracy theories They also lead to other things because they liberate us maybe to thinking, oh, we could be different.
Yes.
Maybe the whole story was wrong and maybe actually there is something in me that I didn't really know yet.
Yes. And that's why I was sticking, that's why in a way I was keeping my cards close and sticking with the doubters at this.
Yeah.
That the skeptics in a way allow me a position where I don't have to say this I think is what, you know, whatever I propose is going to be bunk within 15 years or so.
Right.
But so I do think that there are politically positive things that can come out of it. I do think that we are essentially cyborgs in a way that, you know, ancient hominids were not. You know, maybe they were in some relation to the tools that they used or the clothes that they made and so on and so forth. But, you know, our food comes from, every item that's on our table comes from a different corner of the world. Our relationship to our screens is dramatic enough as to possibly someday have physiological consequences, to put it very vaguely. Our capacity to communicate with people and to, you know, our capacity to drug our bodies and to add various replacement bones and so on are so massive that is a different lifespan, a different relationship to life, a different, you know, capacity to create than they would have had.
Right.
Now, it doesn't mean that that's a good or a bad thing, but it is a fact of, it's a certain fact of life, thanks to which we need to be able to not say we when we refer to that antiquity.
Yeah.
We'll get better stories with a little bit of care, with a little bit greater care.
Yeah.
And at some level, we might start to ask, it's not like we're not asking it, but we're not going to get an easy solution. We're going to have to ask, how do we live 200 years into the future as the cyborgs and energy users and, you know, environment destroyers that we are? It may not be the horrible politics that we know of, you know, the colonial period that I discussed or the Nazi period, which similarly, I think had everything to do with the way that the Nazis imagined, or at least Hitler especially imagined, Aryan Semitic origins. We may not be there, but the environment situation is not exactly doing that great and is not exactly about to do any better. Yeah.
But to do this, we cannot totally dispense with the moral force of an origin story. And the moral power of these stories is so important. And I want to go to maybe one example where you say that a sentence by Charles Darwin was written into a UNESCO declaration right after World War II, sort of where we the shared humanity. And I read the sentence because you make sort of a bit of it and say it's not necessarily right or wrong, but it's an important moment where people take a sentence from Darwin and sort of say, we all are human deep down.
Yes.
And we all connect. And then they make it into a kind of post-World War II racism has brought terrible evil. But I'll have to find the quote. It's
at the very beginning of the next chapter.
Of this next chapter?
The one right after patriarchy. There you go.
Oh, yeah. So I'll read this. This is from Darwin, right? And this is then quoted in after World War II to say we actually share more than that divides us, right? As man advances in civilization and small tribes are united into larger communities, the simplest reason would tell each individual that he ought to extend his social instincts and sympathies to all the members of the same nation, though personally unknown to him. This point being once reached, there's only an artificial barrier to prevent his sympathies extending to the men of all nations and races. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a very lofty and wonderful sentiment to say, we first extend our sympathies to the people in our family, then in our tribe, then our village, our community, our whatever the next organization is, and ultimately to men of all nations and races. Yes. And you think Darwin is problematic? This is written in the
1871, I think it's in the first edition. And
what is made of this idea? That sort of what you're saying, that these, as divide all these stories, all these people are arguing so much, and some of these people we know, and some of these people I didn't know, and they're all arguing about this. But they, if he's saying, but we're all human and we share something, isn't this what the origin sort of stands for?
I think that's right. The funny part is that this paragraph has a history of its own. I only noticed this because I kept finding it. And so in Darwin's version, it's a sort of Victorian top-down, you know, we all can have sympathy for every human being, but most human beings can't have sympathy because they are not that advanced.
Okay. So then we've reached this level, now we can magnanimously...
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. We sort of magnanimously grant this to everybody.
Yeah.
And then after World War II, the argument is twisted to say, we are all human beings, and it's high time. You know, what would UNESCO be if it couldn't say this? And they even have a kind of internal fight as they're preparing the declaration, the statement on race, to say, you know, racism is scientifically bunk. And they include it there. And then since the 80s, there's stage three of this, which is that people who insist that, you know, we are great beings of progress, quote this passage, very often while describing, you know, indigenous brutality or picking stories of indigenous brutality.
Right.
And so Jared Diamond paraphrases it. E.O. Wilson uses it at great length. So there's a way in which...
So Jared
the
Diamond
nuance
is kind of a historian
matters.
Of this...
He, right.
Guns, Germs, and Steel. And what's the next book then he writes?
And then the most more recent big one was The World Until Yesterday.
The World Until Yesterday,
And The World Until Yesterday includes scenes of extraordinarily detailed descriptions of violence among indigenous Papuan peoples. And tries to revise a then existing story that this violence is not that major into an argument that it's really big, utterly brutal, and so on.
Okay.
And there is a way of saying that that is a distinction. Our world and the world until yesterday is something tricky to use this with. Steven Pinker similarly has a scenario where it's like, you know, we're all advancing in all this way, so, you know, universalism is easy. But it turns out universalism hasn't been so easy.
I've had Stanley Fish on this podcast, and he would say, he's very funny, and he would say, and proof to the contrary is all of recorded history.
There you go.
And in some ways, what Stanley Fish is saying, what the pink argument, which I'm not that interested in a way, he would say, there is no proof, actually.
Yeah.
But also, Stanley Fish is very smart. He says recorded history, meaning he knows fully well there's a lot of unrecorded history.
Of course.
But so what you're saying, they're using this argument in the 70s and 80s to sort of say, oh, we are actually more advanced than these sort of indigenous tribes who haven't really reached our state yet.
Okay, or so that they haven't reached the capacity to extend their sympathies and reach peace like we can. You know, that's not working very well for anybody.
But it's not very historical, because maybe there's also a reason why they wouldn't extend their sympathies to the people.
Of course, but also there's a way of just saying, I'm perfectly willing to admit that there are, you know, there are differentials of peace and war under different circumstances. It's more to suggest that definition of humanity, or that description of a definition of humanity, which also is a kind of moral compass, translates into very different political projects.
Okay.
And if, I mean, it appears at the end of the book again to talk about this idea of how innate is our aggression.
Right. So you have, is this the chapter, this is not the chapter, the thin veneer, or this
no,
is sort
it's,
of...
No, but there's a, is... it's a translation. So the way that the book works in a way is that there are these chapters that do more or less the same thing, but try to show how a different language negotiates much the same problem. And how these concepts tell the story of the problem.
So this chapter this now, is this the is the end, later chapter aggression. On aggression. This
right.
is the
it's
chapter.
The, is violence ingrained?
Is violence ingrained and how? Okay,
So that's the scenario. It's to say that there are multiple options. There are multiple ways of using these chapters. I recently learned that, you know, for example, Lech Walesa used it, same passage. It's one of these moments that people, that are easy quotations and easily used because the sentiment sounds excellent.
Right.
And we don't really think, you know, you use this expression and what you mean is other people can't extend their sympathies to the rest of humanity itself.
Okay.
But when the debate comes in, you know, then there can be more tricky, difficult cases.
Right.
So I think there are many, many definitions all through the book where seen on their own sound great. Mm-hmm. Seen in context sound more complicated, sometimes more promising. At other times, they have a kind of promise that's closed off. That's among the things that I find really interesting. There's a promise to something, and then a short while later, it turns out that that promise was
okay.
You know, didn't pan out exactly in any particular way.
And is that how you see your work, kind of as a, like, you're sort of a historian of discourse? So I don't know how you describe your job, actually. Like, how would you describe that? Like, what did you actually do in this book, sort of, I mean, it's a bit academic, but like, what's the genre of this book? It's like a history of histories.
I mean, I think of it as a history of concepts and expressions and images that live on.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not a history of paleontology, that's for sure.
Right, right.
But it is a history of how people think about themselves and about their origins beyond the national level.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way that I would put it. What I was trying to do was to say what we think we are doing. So at some basic level, it's very structuralist, I suppose. What we think we are doing is so determined by the language that we use that the language that we use seeps in and affects the results that come out of it until the language gets reshaped in ways that are actually quite unpredictable or very often quite unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And then as the conceptual web changes or moves, then that history points us in a different direction.
And lets us see also things in the previous ones that we necessarily couldn't see.
Yes.
Like, to be a little bit of a kind of academic nerdy, but I'm quite interested in some, if you thought of your own methodology, like in terms of the big historians, sort of who is your, is this more kind of a Foucauldian analysis, a genealogy rather than a straight up history? Or is it, like, I'm just curious how you situate yourself as an, and maybe you don't have
gulp.
To.
Gulp.
Yeah, so. No, you don't have to at all. But I I'm asking this also for a reason because, you know, we both teach at NYU and I have a lot of students who are, sometimes to my surprise, actually rather interested in these kind of methodological debates of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Is this a Haynes White approach? Is this a Foucault approach? He said it's structuralist, but structuralism sort of, is it going to the direction of more?
Right. I mean, I don't have an exact scenario. The way that I would describe it is that there's a mixture. You know how Roland Barthes used to say that he doesn't have I don't have a method, I have habits. The man who had the method, so to speak. I sort of feel like I have habits. And some habits are, I admire a conceptual history of the style of Kozelek or of Georges Canguilhem, where there are one, two, or more concepts that are related to one another.
Okay.
Two, I do admire a Foucault-style history of, not exactly history, but a study of discourse which has a genealogical set of that changes over time, let's say, but where you also study the human sciences and dimensions of power. So
and
that would be the second.
Remind me, because I've done,
it's been a while.
My Foucault is, like rusty, but like his approach is not historical. He wanted to make a big distinction. He said mine is genealogical. Yes. What's the difference?
I mean, at one level, the way that I would put it is that in the early work, there's a much thicker, denser episteme that is much more determinant of knowledge as it is. And so the question are the epistemological premises rather than the actual results found. But so it's not the results a scientist finds, but the premises that they begin with.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
I'm very close to. I feel very much the pool of historical epistemology in that regard.
The way he writes a history of the birth of the clinic or punish or these stories, like
the switch in, between, let's say, old versions of sovereign power to then disciplinary and securitarian economic power, and so on in that set of lectures.
But you're looking at kind of how concepts, images, metaphors are mobilized, used, adapted, changed, transformed, disputed, but not necessarily are they true or not. And that wasn't Foucault's interest as much. Like he said, it wasn't like they were right, they were wrong.
Right. He goes into the whole argument of truth-telling later on and what that is at stake there. I try to simply balance. It's not whether they're true or not, because I don't, at some basic level, I want to leave it open that things that appear untrue now and resoundingly denounced in a decade maybe back with a vengeance, it just happens too often. So there is an element of that of the Foucault. There's an element of the concepts and metaphors. So that's Kozelek, Canguilhem, and really Blumenberg at some level. I've ended up with a deep admiration of this idea that metaphors are, you know, if not even if they don't precede concepts, that they cohabit a certain world with the concepts.
Okay.
That's why part of the book is expressions, not really. It's committed to expressions, not really concepts. I'm somewhere between all this. I tend to describe these projects as a mixture of a history of concepts and historical epistemology. On what principles did people know what they knew? Or did people know what questions to ask? Not what answers they would get, but what they took for granted.
But I like this, on what principles do they know what they know?
Yeah.
Which is kind of not quite epistemology, but we do know things based on principles that we're not necessarily aware of, or they're so intuitive, or we were taught. I also feel the book is kind of a sort of exciting story, intellectual story. And I think you write in the introduction or in the credits something, you've been teaching a class at NYU for quite a long time that has changed over time.
Yes.
And can you say like one word maybe of how your students or sort of how they, because I think we're all like, I mean, I love Jurassic Park. I like things like that. You know, I do like Black Panther. Like I'm like, there's a certain kind of investment in various stories, and we all grew up. Some of these pictures, the picture on the cover of this book, I grew up with this image.
That's the thing.
Like I saw this and I somehow can, and I'm very cathected as I feel like a child again in a kind of excited way. Like, wow, this is they hunted a mammoth.
I really wanted to include several images like this, which people would kind of be like, oh, I know this.
And you actually show yourself once in the book when say you and your sister watched some TV show. Like once you show up with your sister, you say, we watched a show about like some, like
it took me years to find out what it was. It took me years to figure out what it was.
But you had it in your mind.
I knew. I mean, I knew the images so clearly from it. I remembered the burial of the Neanderthal. We were talking 30, 35 years ago.
And how did this teaching inform this book? Because it's a very, like your style is really, like I actually am really full of admiration for your style for the following reason. That you're very generous and you say these people, some of them may just be kooks and completely off. And then you say sometimes really like sort of slightly ironic, like Freud was wholly unoriginal in this. It's kind of a compliment and also not. Like you don't trash people, you don't say they're all off. You say someone writes a deceptive hodgepodge. We won't name who that is. And these sort of... But how did the teaching inform the writing of this book? Because this is really not a strictly academic book.
Right. So we did all the theory part, and I made every effort to hide the theory in the book and not to write with it, because it matters to me that this be readable. There were multiple ways in which the lectures... so I did this one class that was in the core curriculum, and...
That's a required class
it's for a required
college
class.
NYU students,
So it's not like all students took it, but a number of people, about, you know, 120 students for several years. And one was, you know, in an obvious way, the questions they would ask or the response papers that they would write gave me a sense of what it is that I wasn't aware of, or I wasn't aware, you know, I didn't know I didn't know.
Okay, Okay, that's
I wasn't
you
picking up
yourself
on
not aware that maybe you were... Your thinking was based on premises that you didn't even know.
Yes, exactly.
Like, how did you get there?
I thought like, oh, this is an easy solution, or I would give a lecture, and then people would ask particular things, and then students would also often say so often they would say something quite different than what I'd expected. So the whole discussion of shamanism in the chapter about cave paintings, I had not even noticed, having shown cave paintings, that there are moments in there are moments of discussions of shamans, And I just thought, like, oh, you know, of course. It never occurred to me that there was a specific Michele Eliade story, and then a story, Ernesto De Martino and other people that were in a kind of background. I had no idea. So in many respects, just people picking things up.
So you had to read all this and find out what, there's a much deeper thing to, you thought, shaman, and I get this.
I thought it had always existed.
You had no idea what that was.
Completely post-war story, very specific, big shift. Even with my editor at some point, he said, oh, you've been saying that this is animism and shamanism since the beginning. And I thought, oh, I really don't get it. It's very particular. Yeah. But there was a real way in which the students had made a difference, which is that I had started writing this book as an academic book. And it was getting unwieldy. And I wrote an essay that was 20,000 words long about something extremely specific that basically gets three sentences in the book.
Okay, wow.
It's that's how... And at some point, I realized this was not going to work. Yeah. But what I did do... is I recorded myself lecturing in order to create. So I prepared the PowerPoints and I recorded the lecture that I was giving with very few notes. I would have the quotes, I would have particular elements.
Sure.
But the idea was, if I transcribe this recording,
yeah,
then does it sound like I'm not talking
yeah.
in a thoroughly academic fashion? Am I talking, just as we were saying on another occasion, to somebody who's 18 to 20, has had a year of college.
Like Elle, our student right here.
Hi, Elle.
NYU student. senior, however, much more sophisticated.
Yes. But that was the idea. It was like, if you didn't care to know much more about this, if you came to it out of nowhere, could you actually read it?
But that's on you then to explain enough to keep it interesting, be correct, but keep on translating into several ways for someone who's not an expert to understand that.
Exactly.
So you do this here, and you're very deft at sort of saying, this is the way they're thinking about it. You can think about it this way, and you can follow along. So it's, you're telling a story. Actually.
You're very kind, but that's basically the way that I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be a scenario where people just thought you could pick it up somewhere in the middle of the book and just play with the next 20 pages.
I'm going to ask you another question about this book. So we'll end with this origin fantasy. So... you now have the, you're going to be the cyborg you want to be in 200 years. You have the capacity to travel back in time. You go to some moment in this prehistory. What is the one thing you really want to know? What did they do? What did they not do? And you'll have, you have a 5-minute moment and you can be a safe witness to some scene. What do you want to see?
Oh, man. Wow. Wow. I want to see the cave painters.
Do you want to see the cave painters in action?
The one thing that I love more than anything, it's so peculiar because I tried to come up with, why is it that this is happening? Why am I so moved by these cave paintings that I've never seen the original of, by the way?
And you saw the Werner Herzog movie recently where he thinks they invented cinema. I love the movie until the end when somehow they're all cinematographers. And I'm like... but I don't know if that's what they are, but anyway, see, but there, so you want to be in Lascaux, you want to be inside the cave.
I want to be in Chauvet and just see what it is that they're doing, what it is that they're excited about, why is it that they, why does it move them?
Yeah.
Because at some basic level, there was a period when nobody was making art. And then there was a period when people were making this.
Okay.
I don't know that this is art because I also think it's unfair to give it the term already.
Okay.
It's our term, but I'm so utterly fascinated and moved by these works. Works which sometimes are, you know, they will paint a bison and the shoulder of the bison will be in the part of the wall that's protruding. In other cases, I just saw in a Prehistomania show in Paris, it's called Prehistomania at the Musée de l'Homme, you see some versions of the cave paintings and you realize that the auroch in one case, or a bison or a horse, is inside the cracks of the wall. Like they've kind of made sure that they fill it to a corner, but it feels trapped as though it can't break out of it. Wow. That sort of thing, I'm really moved about. So give me 5 minutes.
Can you visit any of the caves today still, or are most of them closed to
visitors? There are very few who are, where you can visit. They're Combarel, not Combarel. I will make this, I will not get the right one.
Yeah.
But you can visit a couple. You can visit rock paintings in the rest of the world.
I've seen petroglyphs in Australia.
There you go, petroglyphs.
I was very fortunate. I went to Arnhem Land and Kakadu Island, and I saw some petroglyphs.
And so that's
the, there's something, but I think there is something to think that people, someone made this.
Yes.
And in some ways made this, I don't know if this is what you feel, but they communicated something about themselves and their world.
Yes.
And it's very amazing that they communicate, and we can receive this communication.
Yes, we can receive something of this communication, and I can't know what, but I can, you know, I can't know what comes with it. So that indecision, I suppose, is one, but also the sheer idea of what extraordinary involvement, traditions, what must have been generations of painting and scraping into the wall and so on, would have gone into at a time when hunger was real and in ways that would be impossible to imagine today. And it's also, you can visit like Lascaux 2 and Lascaux 3 even, and then Chauvet 2 and so on.
Okay.
But that's not quite the same thing because, as you know, a cave has an almost singular feel to it. You go into a cave and you know the humidity, the dankness, the kind of smell of the cave, the breath of it. Every cave is different. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You can never quite have a sense of what this was supposed to mean or what the cold or and so on.
Right,
so
right.
I'm fascinated by this almost secular holy of holies that comes out of these caves and the immense aura, the hold that they have on me, which I cannot at all explain.
Yeah. I like your Benjaminian moment. It's very nice. You're like, there's time is sort of like, there's this old history right in front of us. Yeah.
Yes,
so thank you, Steph.
Thank you so much, Uli.
The Invention of Prehistory, Empire, Violence, and Our Obsession with Human Origins on the Think About It podcast and video. Thank you, Al, for filming us today. A couple of references we had today, Rousseau, Foucault, Darwin, other people, the other episodes of the podcast, and congratulations on this beautiful book.
Thank you so much, Rudy.
Thank you.
This was perfect.
Thanks. Awesome.